News this week has very much been in the shadow of Charlie Kirk's shooting. We'll have an update on the shooter and the response. We'll look at Donald Trump's trip to England and catch up on a couple of pieces of disturbing nuclear news on today's Trumpet World. The identity of Charlie Kirk's shooter was revealed just as we were going on air last week. We now know a lot more about him. We'll get the latest from our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's just been really a whirlwind of information this week. Like you mentioned before, we found out that the identity of the shooter was 22-year-old Tyler Robinson during our Trumpet Hour recording last week. And at the time, the headlines we were seeing were a little contradictory, showing that, like, okay, on the one hand, his parents are registered Republicans and he's from a Mormon family. On the other hand, he had anti-fascist slogans engraved on his bullets, things like, hey, fascist catch. Like I said, he is from a nominally conservative family, but definitely wasn't conservative himself. In addition to those anti-fascist and other slogans on his bullet casings, we now know that he was in a homosexual relationship with someone roughly his own age who was a man transitioning to be a woman, also dressing as an animal, part of the furry movement, they call that. It's an additional sexual perversion. So into some pretty perverted alternate lifestyles. And then also we know from the governor of Utah that he actually left a letter, which hasn't been made public yet, but espousing many far-left views. There's the theory that he may have actually been associated with the Antifa group and not acted alone. The FBI, FBI Director Kash Patel, is looking into his messages on Discord. That's a social media platform that he was using. And he was in contact with about 20 other people and confessed during one of these Discord conversations that he actually was Charlie Kirk's killer. One thing, some of these members on his Discord chat were associated with a group called Armed Queers SLC. So Kash Patel at the FBI is looking into exactly what role that group played, because if he was actually part of that group and that group was operating in the Kirk assassination, that's extremely significant. The Armed Queers SLC, they took their website down immediately after the assassination, so it looks like they've got something they were trying to hide. One of the interesting things is, and some news sources like the New York Post are really highlighting this, is the Armed Queers SLC is partially funded and connected with the Party of Socialism and Liberation. That's a bigger neo-Marxist group that was involved in making a lot of the signs and placards at the Los Angeles riots earlier this year. So a group that's involved in trying to foment unrest across the United States in an attempt to, like, stir up a Bolshevik-style revolution. And this group, the Party of Socialism and Liberation, is funded through a black money network, in large part by a billionaire named Neville Singham. He's an American businessman who's currently in exile in communist China for his efforts to finance groups in the United States, like the Party of Socialism and Liberation, which is making signs at riots like the Los Angeles riots, trying to stir up things like that, which is funding this group called Armed Queers SLC, which may or may not be associated with Tyler Robinson and the Charlie Kirk assassination. That's not a formal charge that's been made, but it is a theory that the FBI is looking into pretty aggressively right now. Just kind of putting this in context, in that, like, this was a political assassination by a radical leftist influenced by Antifa ideology who was trying to silence Charlie Kirk for convincing college students that Christianity and conservatism actually had something to offer. the Soviet Union financed social unrest in the U.S. All the time. And it does seem like the Chinese Communist Party has at least picked up that mantle somewhat and is working through people like Neville Singham.
So that's one of the big developments we've had on the Charlie Kirk story this last week. The other one seems to be that we are now seeing more division over the aftermath of the shooting. Like for the few days afterwards, maybe even for the weekend afterwards, America seemed pretty solidly united, or those that were criticizing Charlie Kirk were kind of in the minority. Now, though, you had Barack Obama come out this week, and, well, this is what he had to say on the situation.
You have to recognize that on both sides, undoubtedly, there are people who are extremists and who say things that are contrary to what I believe are America's core values. But I will say that those extreme views were not in my White House. I wasn't embracing them. I wasn't empowering them. I wasn't putting the weight of the United States government behind extremist views. And that is when we have the weight of the United States government behind extremist views, we've got a problem.
So in that clip, he's kind of implying, well, President Trump and his administration, okay, the shooter might not have been right-wing, but the Trump administration is somehow to blame for this, for their divisive, violent rhetoric, which, and the hypocrisy of the left in general, but Barack Obama in particular, like, that he could get up there and say, well, we never allowed any divisive or extreme rhetoric while I was in the, like, you know, he stirred up the situation of race massively. Anytime that there was any racial element to any shooting, a black person being shot by a white man, you know, he really played that up. He did so much to divide the country, yet he'll come out and I mean, so much of the climate is there because of him, and yet he's there now trying to put the blame on Donald Trump. And now we've also started to see a bit of a pushback from the left on this cancel culture, as they're calling it. So you had some people say some pretty horrible things in the aftermath of the Charlie Kirk shooting. I think you shared an article with me earlier in the week that talked about, okay, America's had political assassinations and assassination attempts before. Okay, in some ways, this isn't new. What is new is the fact that people are out there celebrating instead of being horrified. And so you've had people celebrating, you've had people lose their jobs. And now you're getting some pushback again, kind of led by Barack Obama and others on the left against that. So he tweeted out, after years of complaining about cancel culture, the current administration has taken it to a new and dangerous level by routinely threatening regulatory action against media companies unless they muzzle or fire reporters and commentators it doesn't like. So we're getting some pushback now, and we're getting the left, I guess, trying to blame Donald Trump, and potentially, it even seems further divide the country after this shooting.
Yeah, it is. This really does highlight just how close America is to a civil war. I think the article I shared with you was written by the article was in The Independent, so it's actually a British newspaper, but it was written by someone who wrote a book called America's Next Civil War. And like I said, yeah, if you go back to the 1982 assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan, Reagan was a very quick-witted president, and so he's actually, just before he went into surgery to have the bullets removed, he woke up and looked up at all the doctors around him, and he kept his sense of humor even in the midst of tragedy. He said, "I hope you're all Republicans." And then the doctor responded, he's like, "Well," he's like, "we are all Republicans today, sir." Which I think that scene from Reagan's life just highlights how different America was in the 1980s, that when the president had an attempted assassination attempt, for a while at least, there wasn't a difference between the Republican and Democratic reaction. Just the entire nation was horrified that someone shot the president. Now here you have Charlie Kirk, who's not the president, but someone who was very influential in getting President Trump elected. I've seen some commentary saying that Trump might not be president if it wasn't for Charlie Kirk, because he did a ton to bring young people over to President Trump's side. And like the day of the shooting, it seemed like there was kind of an outcry, a unified outcry at how horrible this political violence was. But it's been less than 2 weeks, and we're already getting people in the Democratic Party, even pretty high up, as high up as Barack Obama, who are saying that, like, well, yes, political violence is bad, but Charlie Kirk kind of had it coming because of what he was saying. And what he was saying is something that, like, was stuff that was mainstream when your grandparents were alive. So his views are not extreme. And so it's there is kind of like a four-dimensional chess almost going on here. It's like I said, where these assassination attempts are happening because you have Barack Obama and the mainstream media just repeating over and over and over and over and over again what a racist, white nationalist, fascist Charlie Kirk was for saying things that were normal in 2005. And then when you double, and now when the assassination happens, you condemn that, but you still keep repeating the talking points, the untrue talking points that got him assassinated in the first place. When you get to that point where you've actually got people happy that someone from the other side was killed, you're on the cusp of civil war, because we definitely, we were at that point in the 1850s before the first civil war broke out. So the division today is way worse than it was in the 1980s, like approaching like 1850s level, and just showing how close America can be to a civil war, which is really prophetically significant, because we've pointed out many times, well, actually, an article we can put in the show notes, it was after Donald Trump was elected the first time in 2016, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, actually wrote an article titled America's Coming Civil War, where he was highlighting some of the comments that Van Jones and others made about the Trump election and how the division was pointing to another civil war in America. And there's prophecies in Isaiah 1:7 about your cities being burned with fire, and Isaiah 3:5 through 8, and then Ezekiel 5:12 about even like a third of the population, that's 100 million people in the United States, dying in pestilence and rioting. So some sobering Bible prophecies about civil war, that the societal divisions weren't bad enough for something like that to happen in the 1980s and the 1990s, and we started seeing more of it in the Bush-Gore election, but definitely not as bad as it is today.
So some sobering and important prophecies, and I want to get into a bit of good news related to some of that in just a moment as I talk about some UK news. Did you have any other bits of news to bring us, though, from the US and the English-speaking world?
Yeah, I think two other stories in addition to the UK news that you're going to highlight momentarily. One highlighting more social division in America, related but not exactly part of the Charlie Kirk story, is something we wrote up in other news in one of our morning briefs this week about Dearborn, Michigan, which actually has, it's a Muslim-majority city. I think it's got the biggest Muslim population in the United States. They recently named two street intersections after an Arab journalist who's really praised both Hamas and Hezbollah. And then one of the Dearborn residents, who is a Christian.
I mean, Hezbollah, bombed the embassy in Beirut, and including many Americans. So I just feel it's quite inappropriate.
You're an Islamophobe. And although you live here, I want you to know, as mayor, you are not welcome here. And the day you move out of the city will be the day that I launch a parade celebrating the fact that you moved out of the city.
So another story that comes in the similar spirit to people celebrating Kirk's murder, where it's now you've got Christians in the United States who just say that we shouldn't have street signs glorifying Hezbollah terrorists, who are being ostracized in their own city in the American heartland for saying something that is really just common sense. Also, some economic news that's going to make a lot of people happy, although it may have some bad long-term consequences, is the Federal Reserve, after much pressure from Donald Trump for very long, has cut the Federal Reserve interest rate by 25 basis points. So the rate's now gone down to between 4 and 4.25%. That move has caused mortgage loan interest rates to drop to their lowest level in 3 years. It's a 0.25% cut isn't huge, but it does make it a little cheaper to borrow money. So allowing people that like cheaper mortgages, cheaper car loans, cheaper credit card loans, just cheaper to borrow money in general, which could really fuel an economic boom in the United States, especially if the Federal Reserve follows this up with a couple more rate cuts. This has been something Donald Trump's wanted for a long time, and Jerome Powell's been very reluctant to do because, and he is right about this, because the big, beautiful bill approved a $2 trillion deficit. He's like, if we've got if you make it cheap to borrow money at a time with those big deficits, inflation may come back. He's wanting to get the inflation down to 2%. It's just above 2%, but like a rate cut like this, it'll stimulate the economy, make it cheaper to buy a car, make it cheaper to buy a house, but the inflation could come back. And by making it so much cheaper to borrow money, could fuel both a, well, it doesn't need to fuel a government borrowing boom because the government borrows money no matter what the interest rate was, but could also fuel more consumer debt problems down the line.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. Maybe I'll keep you around just for a few more minutes as this story also impacts the United States, and you, in case you have any comments as well. But I wanted to talk about the welcome that Britain gave to President Donald Trump this week. That was another pretty significant event where the royal family, the prime minister, really went all out in welcoming Donald Trump. He became the first ever elected leader to be invited for a second state visit to the UK. He was the first president since Ronald Reagan to stay the night at Windsor Castle. There are a few things, I think, around Windsor Castle where he was the first ever. Windsor Castle, of course, the biggest and oldest inhabited castle in the world. He received a massive military welcome. There was an incredible banquet. And what stood out to there was so much attention to detail in this banquet. And Donald Trump doesn't even drink, but the drinks menu, for example, there was so much fine detail. They served cognac from 1912, the year that President Trump's mother was born in Scotland. The port was from 1945 for the 45th president. You had fly passes and military parades. Actually, I enjoyed this. Let's play. This is one of my favorite clips from the fly past. So really, quite a spectacle. I mean, before I talk about it a little more, Andrew, like, what was there much of a view on that from the US? Did it even cut through the news? I think, understandably, people's minds were still on Charlie Kirk and things like that. Is that, what was the view from America of the visit?
I haven't seen much news coverage on it in the United States, actually, just because I think that the Charlie Kirk thing overshadowed it. Few comments on Twitter, actually. I think because they, like you said, they went really out of their way to make this very special for Donald Trump with the orchestra playing the YMCA song he likes. Also, I heard the orchestra playing like the American National Anthem. I'd seen a couple comments just kind of justifiably mulling over just how far the United States and Britain have have come, that you've gone from like your anthem is actually written about a pretty vicious war you had with Britain, and now you've got the King of England actually having his orchestra play that in a way to honor his alliance, his special relationship with the United States president. That's something that I think Winston Churchill coined that term, special relationship. So at least since World War II, America and Britain have been very close allies. I've seen some people just commenting at that, like, wow, it's like, it's just amazing how how much the relationship between those two nations has changed in the last 200 years.
Yeah, that's true. And this is something Donald Trump brought up himself. I thought he was a very gracious host. This was the toast. This is a bit from the toast that he made at dinner. I really enjoyed this speech, and well, I think you'll be able to see why.
A fifth of all of humanity speaks, writes, thinks, and prays in the language born on these isles and perfected in the pages of Shakespeare and Dickens and Tolkien, Lewis, Orwell, and Kipling. Incredible people, unbelievable people like we have rarely seen before, probably won't see again. The lion-hearted people of this kingdom defeated Napoleon, unleashed the Industrial Revolution, destroyed slavery, and defended civilization in the darkest days of fascism and communism. The British gave the world the Magna Carta, the modern parliament, and Francis Bacon's scientific method. They gave us the works of Locke and Hobbes, Smith and Burke, Newton and Blackstone. The legal, intellectual, cultural, and political traditions of this kingdom have been among the highest achievements of mankind. There's really never been anything like it. The British Empire laid the foundations of law, liberty, free speech, and individual rights virtually everywhere the Union Jack has ever flown, including a place called America. You know that place very well, don't you? His Majesty spoke eloquently about the bond which inspired Sir Winston Churchill, and the bust is in the Oval Office right now, the beautiful bust of Winston Churchill, to coin the phrase special relationship. But seen from American eyes, the word special does not begin to do it justice. We're joined by history and fate, and by love and language, and by transcendent ties of culture, tradition, ancestry, and destiny. We're like two notes in one chord or two verses of the same poem, each beautiful on its own, but really meant to be played together. The bond of kinship and identity between America and the United Kingdom is priceless and eternal. It's irreplaceable and unbreakable. And we are, as a country, as you know, doing unbelievably well. We had a very sick country 1 year ago, and today I believe we're the hottest country anywhere in the world. In fact, nobody's even questioning it, but we owe so much of that to you and the footing that you gave us when we started. Together we've done more good for humanity than any two countries in all of history. Together we must defend the exceptional heritage that makes us who we are, and we must continue to stand for the values and the people of the English-speaking world, and we do indeed stand for that.
But one of the things I really like from that speech is, you know, we started the show talking about the darkness and suffering that is coming because of division within the United States. And here, though, is a speech all about the benefits to the world that comes from a unity between two nations, and a unified relationship between two nations. And just the wonderful good that it did to the, did for the world. Now, this isn't a call from me. Like, unity at any price is not a good thing. I'm not going to say up here, well, America needs to just come together with the radical left. You know, this good unifying with evil doesn't lead to good outcomes. This is not about shaking hands with enemies and sitting down and singing Kumbaya. But when there's a unity based on God, based on God's law, based on what God is doing in the world, there can be a lot of good. There always will be a lot of good that comes from that. And I think, you know, Mr. Trump's speech, where he points to the history of Britain and America, is so refreshing because he's giving this in an environment where this has been denigrated. I mean, Barack Obama sends home the Churchill bust, and he's always talking about America's history as being evil, and his whole movement is behind the 1619 Project, and oh, America's founded by slavery. The whole narrative is Britain and America were only great because they stole everything from everybody else. And Donald Trump rightly points out, no, Britain ended slavery. I mean, Britain led an incredible effort to shut down the slave trade. And there's thinking and philosophy from these countries that have benefited the entire world. I mean, that true picture is just refreshing. And you can take it one step further, that the good from this relationship is a good that comes from God and the Bible. The good ideas that Britain and America have spread around the world are things like equality before the law. They're things like that the ruler isn't there to lord it over. The person in charge is there to serve the people. I mean, these are biblical principles. And these are principles, okay, maybe they're not there perfectly, and perhaps not even integrated perfectly into some of these founding documents, but that's the thinking behind a lot of these documents. But ultimately, this history and the good that these nations have done is a massive signpost to point back to God. Britain and America have had a history with God. And we gave a whole show on this a few weeks back about why have Britain and America been great, and why have they been great together? I mean, that's an element that I thought was just really refreshing that Donald Trump pointed to. We always, I'm as guilty as the next man. I think, you know, some friendly rivalry can be, is kind of fun, but, you know, we often do put down other countries and things like that. But there's a greatness that is there from both of these countries working together. And that stems from God's promises to Abraham. As we covered on the show on the subject, Britain and America are descended from Abraham. And God promised spiritual salvation through Jesus Christ to Abraham. You look in Genesis chapter 12, and there are promises of wealth, of power. You know, there's specific, very tangible, physical promises. A lot of descendants. Control of the gates of your enemy, like geopolitical choke points. The kinds of things that aren't fulfilled in a church or in Jesus Christ. There are national promises to Abraham's physical descendants as well. And Mr. Flory wrote, God chose them, these descendants of Abraham, that includes Britain and America, not because they were better or because he wanted to give them special favor, but to use them as an example to other nations. And Mr. Armstrong called the blessings given to Britain and America the strongest proof of the inspiration and authority of the Holy Bible. He also said it is at the same time the strongest proof of the very active existence of the living God. And so even though a lot of people don't realize it, Donald Trump's state visit and his speech, you know, he's putting God's authority and power on display by holding up that history. Now, really, President Trump needs to lead both nations in acknowledging God as the source of those blessings and turning to him. That's the only way to have those blessings return. But still, it's great to see at least part of that signpost put up there. And Mr. Stephen Flory spoke about this on the Trumpet Daily Show yesterday. And he pointed to an article that we had a few years ago that we can put in the show notes about, well, Britain and America are going to dominate the world again, or they're going to be great again. And these two nations together, you know, they'll be more than just a passive signpost pointing to God, that with their history pointing the world to God, they'll actively be leading the world to God. But this year marks the 80th anniversary of the publication of Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And that book contains the master key that unlocks all Bible prophecy and brings world news and history to life. And you could be very happy. We'd be very happy to send you a free copy of that, and you can read it online as well. We have all of those, all of our different books and booklets available, or most of them, for you to read and study online too. But we see the danger of division, and you know, America heading in the direction of a civil war that, you know, the Bible talks about killing amounts of people that's just hard to grasp, get our minds around. I think intellectually we can know a civil war will be very destructive, but the numbers in the Bible that the Bible prophecy warns about are just incredible. On the flip side, though, you know, we have if we found a unity on obedience to God and obedience to God's law, I mean, you get a tiny foretaste of that in looking back at the history that Donald Trump talked about. And what the good that's going to come from a unity in the future when Britain and America have repented, when that correction, when that suffering have led both nations back to God, it's going to make the good that's been done in the past seem incredibly puny by comparison. And also, it's not just going to be a unity between Britain and America. You know, Isaiah talks about Assyria and Egypt being unified with Israel, working together with Israel. And the entire world is going to reap some incredible, some wonderful benefits of that. But the point of that is, though, that it needs to be founded on these nations looking back to God. And I think that's part of the danger from this trip, is there is Britain relying on Donald Trump. And I think there's some good news in Britain kind of relying more on America. I'd much rather Britain have a relationship with America and a close relationship with America than a close relationship with Europe and the European Union. You know, the political traditions of both are very, very different. You know, I think we might get into this a little bit with Simon in just a few, or we might get into this in just a little bit with Mihailo in a few minutes. But you know, like Spain has a history of like 500 years of anti-Semitism and hating on the Jews and attacking the Jews, and that spirit is not dead when you see the Spanish Prime Minister come out like he did this week and fantasize about nuking Israel. Yeah, but Europe's heritage isn't free speech. We see even today their attitude to free speech massively different to the traditional attitude in Britain and America. Their attitude to freedom in general, to authority, it's a very different background. So in some ways, yeah, I think it's great to see these countries drawing together, and it does kind of revive memories of some of that glorious history. I did like that somebody in the Telegraph wrote, by the way, can we do a swap, another one in, one out policy after Donald Trump's visit? Can we give America Sir Keir Starmer, and can we keep Donald Trump as our prime minister? So there was some that, you know, a lot of that aspects has been well received, but there is a danger there in Britain more and more doing the same thing that America is doing and potentially looking to and relying on Donald Trump instead of looking to and relying on God. You know, though, we've talked a lot about the symbolism from this trip. In terms of practical takeaways, one of the big things that came away from this deal is this new memorandum on future technology that was signed between Keir Starmer and Donald Trump. The two are going to cooperate in artificial intelligence, nuclear energy, quantum computing, recognize each other's standards. It does sound a bit pie in the sky, but actually there's a lot of substance there, particularly in the recognizing each other's standards. So Eurointelligence wrote, with this deal, the EU is repositioning itself firmly on the American regulatory side on all the important technologies of the 21st century and away from the EU. This is the area of regulation that matters the most for future economic prosperity. Telegraph's Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he wrote that it comes close to killing off the rejoiner dream, this effort to undo Brexit, once and for all. And European regulation, you know, it gets in the way of a lot of what American tech companies are doing. I mean, it's a relatively minor example, but Apple recently unveiled new software that will instantaneously translate foreign languages. And they've got their particular brand of AirPods that can translate an in-person conversation in real time. You can sit down with someone, they'll talk to you in one language, and you'll automatically hear from your earpiece the translation. But not in the EU, because European regulation makes it much harder for Apple to do it there. Like I said, that's, I think, it's a pretty minor example, but there's hundreds of these that get in the way of the US doing business in Europe. And this new deal with mutual recognition of regulatory standards, you know, Britain is siding with America and going down America's path in very tangible ways with all of this future technology. And you go back to what Mr. Flurry, some of the very first articles he was writing about Donald Trump, and about Donald Trump fulfilling this type of a biblical King Jeroboam that was used to, he was used to stop the name of Israel being blotted out in Israel, stop Israel being conquered, but then failed to point the nation to God. And he drew attention to a passage in Hosea 5, verses 9 to 11, which talks about Ephraim, or Britain in Bible prophecy, saying that they willingly walked after the commandment of Jeroboam. And he wrote that people in Britain are going to be led astray by Jeroboam. They're going to be led more and more deeply into sin. Now that the United Kingdom has decided to break away from Europe, it will be more desperate to trade with the US. This will probably result in following Jeroboam's lead into disaster. And that is what happened this week. Sir Keir Starmer is reflexively pro-EU. He would love to rejoin the EU. But he's desperate for trade deals. He's desperate for help in the economy. And America's more willing to make them. Donald Trump is more willing to make them than Europe is. So if he has to kind of change direction a bit, he's doing it. And he's more they're desperate to trade with the US, exactly as Mr. Flurry talked about. But what these nations need to recapture those wonderful, it wasn't just unity between Britain and America that made these two nations a blessing to the world. It was promises from God that made these two nations a blessing to the world. And that's what these nations need to get back to. And so I think there's a lot of good things from that aspect of the news, and good news and hopeful stories. But there's also that danger that they're looking to a man instead of to God. Mr. Flurry wrote, "We need a leader who will cause our people to embrace the living God, not a puny, helpless man. The modern-day Jeroboam, or Donald Trump, fights for many good causes, but in the process, he gets people to look to him as the solution, not the omnipotent, all-powerful God. This is the great deception and the great sin." And we've seen that, sadly, in his second term, where he talks about, well, I can bring peace. I can solve anything. And that's not true. And the way to bring peace is to get people looking to God as the source of peace. So there's correction coming to both these nations, but there's going to be a lot of good coming when these nations have learned from that correction. Well, I wanted to run down just a quick few other European stories as well. The German arms giant Rheinmetall took an important step to becoming a naval powerhouse on Sunday. They announced plans to take over a major German warship manufacturer. So Rheinmetall, they make a lot of guns and things that are used on ships, but they don't build ships themselves yet. But they're going to buy naval vessels Lürssen. It's a military division of Lürssen Group. It's meant to be worth 1.52 billion euros, 1.6 billion US dollars, something like that. A deal should go through at the start of the year if it's approved by European authorities. Their CEO said, "We're creating a vital German powerhouse for state-of-the-art vessels." Their press release said Rheinmetall intends to meet the massive increase in demand from naval forces. The history of Lürssen, naval vessels Lürssen, is interesting. They started making rowing boats in 1875. They partnered with Gottlieb Daimler to build the world's first power boat. By World War I, they were making patrol boats, faster track craft, and making warships for the Nazis in the 1930s. They also, the group naval vessels Lürssen, they now include Blumenvoss, which is the shipyard that made the Bismarck, probably Germany's most famous World War II battleship, along with a whole lot of U-boats. Their shipyards have built over 1,000 ships for 50 navies and coast guards. And this is going to give Germany another major naval champion alongside ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems, which is due to be spun off from its parent company later this year. So we're seeing more. This is a German company buying another German company, but it is still a step towards Germany creating some of the massive defense giants like you see in the United States. And this, of course, was on the front cover of our latest Trumpet print edition, where Mr. Flurry wrote, "Germany's great industrial power is being rapidly transformed for military purposes. Germany is already Europe's largest military spender, but it is only at the beginning of a frightening military transformation." We also saw a couple of stories about the Alternative for Deutschland, this far-right party within Germany this week. You had local elections in Nordrhein-Westfalia. This was closely watched as one of the first local elections for Friedrich Merz, a big test for his power. He, I think, breathed a bit of a sigh of relief. They lost a little support, but his party still came in first place. So they weren't too disappointed with that. They won about a third of the vote. But the big news is that the AfD roughly tripled their vote. They went from 5% in 2020 to 15% or 14.5% in this election. Now, that's a fair bit lower than their polling locally, but this is still a very big deal for them because the AfD traditionally, or over the last 10 years or so, has done really well in Eastern Germany and then kind of struggled a bit in the West. And so they come out in second or first place with about a quarter of the vote because they have a whole ton of support in the East. This rise of support in the more populous, more wealthy West and the fact that they could triple their vote in the West, I mean, that starts to show again that they're building power as a national party in Germany. And that they're, well, the state premier said, this result must give us pause for thought. It means we cannot rest easy. They're a growing power within Germany. Then you had one of the AfD's top politicians reportedly came to the White House, Beatrix von Storch, their deputy leader, and then Joachim Paul, a member who was recently barred from running to mayor. We don't know much about what went on there. You know, I think the AfD does address and talk about some good causes, despite also having some members that exalt Germany's Nazi history and Nazi leaders and even just Nazism itself. So you keep watching the rise of the AfD, and that's a dangerous thing, again, because I think he's looking to himself for these guidance and for these decisions instead of going to God and to the Bible. You know, Donald Trump is helping the rise of this party. And we have an article, Nazism Rises Again in Germany, by Mr. Flurry from this time last year, that talks about that. Well, thank you for sticking around for a few more minutes. Andrew, I guess we can let you go now, and we'll get the latest from the Middle East from Mihailo Zekic.
News broke yesterday. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan have agreed to a mutual defense alliance. That basically means they have their own version of NATO. An attack on one is an attack on all or both in this case. In practical terms, if this alliance existed at the beginning of the year, that means when India and Pakistan had their war, that would have meant war between India and Saudi Arabia as well. Pakistan is the only Muslim-majority country that has control over its own nuclear weapons. Does this mean that Saudi Arabia now has protection under Pakistan's nuclear umbrella? Well, Reuters asked a Saudi official that. They didn't name who it was, but the official responded, quote, "This is a comprehensive defense agreement that encompasses all military means." In other words, yes, Saudi Arabia is now under Pakistan's nuclear umbrella. Well, for years, including before the October 7th massacre in 2023, the Saudis have even been pushing for their own nuclear program. They even offered to recognize Israel if the U.S. helped them start up their own program. And the U.S. said yes, on the condition that it's for civilian purposes only and that there are safeguards to make sure it's for civilian purposes only. And Saudi Arabia said, no, we're not taking that. It's pretty obvious then what they're looking for a nuclear program for. Well, this is a clip from Fox News' Brett Baier interviewing the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. He basically runs the country under his father. We've played this before, but it's a pretty good... but it helps encapsulate what the Saudis are thinking.
When we are concerned of any country getting a nuclear weapon, that's a bad move. And you don't need to get a nuclear weapon because you cannot use it. Even if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, any country use a nuclear weapon, that means they are having a war with the rest of the world. The world cannot see another Hiroshima. If the world see 100,000 people dead, that means you are in a war with the rest of the world. So it's a useless effort to reach a nuclear weapon because you cannot use it. If you use it, you got to have a big fight with the rest of the world.
If they get one, will you?
If they get one, we have to get one for security reasons and for balancing power in the Middle East. But we don't want to see that.
So Saudi Arabia is not the only country in the Middle East that wants a nuclear weapon. Iran also wants a nuclear weapon. Iran is also a terrorist-sponsoring nation, and Iran is just across the sea, the Persian Gulf, from Saudi Arabia. But why would Saudi Arabia be worried about Iran if, a few months ago, there was a 12-day war, Israel struck Iran's nuclear sites, the United States struck Iran's nuclear sites? What are they afraid of? Well, Britain, France, and Germany, or the E3, are about to put snapback sanctions, economic sanctions, on Iran. French President Emmanuel Macron this week told Israeli media that this is a done deal, that they're not planning on going back on it, that these sanctions will happen. And Iran is threatening to leave the non-proliferation treaty of nuclear weapons in response to that, which basically says, it's their declaration, we want a nuclear bomb. We're not even going to pretend anymore, and we are going to race towards it. So even if these strikes have set Iran back, Iran still wants a bomb and looks like they have the capability to get a bomb. If they didn't have the capability, they wouldn't be inviting this more conflict with the rest of the world. Tying that in, again, with Saudi Arabia's history of trying to get a nuclear weapon, of the prince's comments before, it looks like the Saudis are still scared of Iran. It looks like they know something the general public doesn't. And this fits in exactly with something our editor-in-chief, Mr. Jira Fleur, has been watching for years. There's a verse we go to over and over again in this program, Daniel 11, verse 40, which speaks of a king of the south and a king of the north clashing in this end time. In his free book, The King of the South, Mr. Fleury says that the king of the south is radical Islam led by Iran, and the king of the north is a European bloc led by Germany, which we just spoke about. And Mr. Fleury sees Iran's nuclear weapons program as a huge part of what starts that clash. And Mr. Fleury, 12-day war aside, still expects Iran to keep pushing to acquire a nuclear weapon and for this to cause this war that's coming. In other words, Iran's not finished. Iran is not out of the game. And when you see countries like Saudi Arabia like this, acting this way, even signing a deal with Pakistan, which is not a country known for not getting into wars, that tells you that there are some serious things going on in Iran right now, and that the Saudis are scared, and you need to keep watching what's going on in Iran and with their nuclear weapons program. The King of the South, that free book, again, we can put a link in the show notes, can help explain all of that.
So a continued high-profile role for nuclear weapons in world events. What else do you want to update us on from the Middle East?
So a couple of stories. This one's more of a long-term trend, but it has seen some developments. Turkey is seeing some of its largest protests in years right now, with hundreds of thousands of people packing the streets of Istanbul and other major cities. This comes as Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is en masse arresting members of the political opposition there, the Republican People's Party, his secular democratic rivals. Just this week, one of the district mayors of Istanbul was arrested on corruption charges. The head mayor of Istanbul has been arrested for a while now, and if memory serves me right, I don't have the stats in front of me, but well over 100 mayors of this democratic party in all parts of Turkey have been arrested again on these similar corruption charges. The parties had their congresses meddled with by the government. It very much looks like, even though elections in Turkey aren't for another few years, that President Erdogan is trying to neuter the political opposition as much as possible, and the people can see that, and they're trying to say something about it. Turkey is a very important country in Bible prophecy. It's identified by with the ancient people of Edom. We have two articles in our most recent Trumpet Print Edition that discuss Edom and what Bible prophecy has to say about that. Where these protests factor in is unknown at this point, but it's still a major crisis rocking this very important, very geostrategic country, and so it's something to keep an eye on. And one other one, a bit of positive news, Fiji inaugurated, on the other side of Asia, the Asian sphere, I guess you could say, but Fiji inaugurated a new embassy in Jerusalem on Wednesday, making it one of the handful of countries that recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The Fijian Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rabuka, he even went over to Israel for the inauguration, standing side by side with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, good for Fiji for acknowledging reality, and B, standing with Israel in its really tough time of need when you see so many countries around the world trying to marginalize Israel. And again, another country recognizing Jerusalem as the capital. There is a sizable, not huge, but sizable Muslim population in Fiji. And guess what? The world's not ending. The Middle East isn't going up in flames, unlike what many people predicted when President Trump moved his embassy. And life, as normal as can be, is continuing forward.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. While it's not just the Middle East that is gearing up for nuclear war, our Asia news revolves around that as well. And to hear about it, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. Russia rehearsed the launching of nuclear weapons in Belarus this week. This was on Tuesday during some war games that Russian forces were conducting with Belarusian forces. The war games are called Zapad 2025. And the nuclear part of these exercises mostly involves tactical weapons, which are smaller and generally short range. But they also included some of Russia's Oreshnik hypersonic missiles in these exercises as well. The Oreshnik is an extremely lethal weapon. These are intermediate range ballistic missiles. It can carry multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles and can probably carry up to 6 nuclear warheads each. And then Belarus is, of course, in Europe. It's part of Eastern Europe, only a few hundred miles away from Berlin and much closer to other European capitals. So this sort of rehearsal to fire nuclear weapons, including the Oreshnik, is extremely alarming to European leaders and people. Military analyst Alexander Oleskin talked this week about just how worrisome this is. He said that from Europe's point of view, Russia has turned Belarus into a balcony looming over the West. So that's a sobering image there. And these nuclear war games, of course, they come just days after Russia launched a bunch of suicide drones into Poland's airspace, which we spoke about last week. And it comes as Russia is ramping up its air attacks on Ukraine's civilian centers. And we can be certain that all of this has Europe very much on edge. And of course, we can even see evidence of that in the headlines, with Europe's dramatic return to militarism, the expanding military budgets of European nation, the return of conscription for some of them as well, the decision by Germany to establish a permanent base in Lithuania. That's Germany's first permanent military base abroad since World War II. So an extremely significant development there. We also see it in Europe's moves towards producing its own weapons and defense systems instead of relying so much on the United States and other outside powers. So Europe is very much awake to the Russian threat. They are alarmed and they are reacting to that threat by actively preparing for war. And this is something that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been warning about for more than 20 years now, ever since Vladimir Putin's earliest moves toward authoritarianism. And one of his more recent articles about this is in our September 2023 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet, and it focuses on just how rapidly this has been happening since Russia's war on Ukraine went full scale. This article is called "Russia's War on Ukraine is Reshaping Europe," and it's built around Bible prophecies about Europe soon rising up as another resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, extremely violent and domineering. Daniel chapter 2 is one of the big ones that shows that, and it shows that this European empire will be made up of 10 nations or groups of nations. And I'll just read a part of this article. It says, "The Trumpet and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, have been prophesying for around 80 years that Eastern Europe would become a crucial part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire that has risen up so many times in Europe. This prophecy is directly related to Russia's war on Ukraine. The terror that is gripping so many Europeans because of Russia's brutal invasion is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite their nations or groups of nations dramatically and in exact accordance with the Bible's prophecies about that European empire." And then just a little further down, he says, "Europe's fear of Putin's Russia next door will help shape and form the Holy Roman Empire rather suddenly, end quote. So Europe has been extremely alarmed by Russia's belligerence for years now, and to see Russia now rehearsing right there in Eastern Europe to use nuclear weapons, you know, we can be sure that that is intensifying Europe's fear of Russia, and it'll be hastening Europe's militarization and unification even more. And for anyone who would like to understand all of these developments in the prophetic context, the name of that article, once again, is Russia's War on Ukraine is Reshaping Europe.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Any other stories from Asia we need to be aware of before we wrap up?
Yes, I wanted to talk about a story showing Russia and China drawing closer together. This is a development, of course, that the Trump has been monitoring for years as these two nations become allies. And it's usually it's about the military realm that we generally speak about, or in economics or politics that we see them drawing closer to each other. But this week, a report showed that there is also more and more marriages happening between the people of Russia and the people of China. And this makes sense when you remember China's one-child policy that they had in place for decades. That policy led to tens of millions of abortions of girls, baby Chinese girls, because when you can only have one child, and when you live in a nation that is extremely patriarchal and misogynistic, no one wants a girl. So after decades of that, China today has way too many men who can't find brides. They actually have about 30 million more men in China than women. So a serious demographic imbalance there. And then Russia has exactly the opposite problem. Their men are dying in the war or being badly wounded or fleeing Russia to escape the war. Russia's men also die of alcoholism and drug abuse and suicide at extremely high rates, significantly higher than Russian women. So the result of all this is that Russia now has at least 10 million more women than men, and that gap is growing all the time. So what we're seeing now is that many Chinese men are gazing north for a bride, and more marriages are happening between Chinese men and Russian women. So it's an interesting development showing that Russia and China are drawing nearer, and not just in the, you know, the pragmatic geopolitical ways that we generally discuss. And then I had just one final story here about Russia and China using the assassination of Charlie Kirk to deepen divisions between Americans and just to make Americans hate each other even more than we already do. So Russia and China do this partly with journalists who are not afraid to publish articles that are basically fiction, but they label them as fact. And from there, they use armies of bots and trolls, individuals who are paid to just be online all day, and they spend their time promoting those false articles and also posting endless comments. In these comments, they often masquerade as American leftists celebrating the assassination, or they pretend to be right-wingers, calling for Democrat blood and making all kinds of, you know, racist comments and things like that. So this is, it's called black propaganda, and the Russians and Chinese use this just to stir the pot and just to try to intensify the hatred on both sides as much as they can. They've also been promoting all kinds of conspiracy theories about the assassination, saying, for example, that Israel's Secret Service was behind it, or that Ukraine was behind it, or any number of other groups. These claims all contradict each other, and they generally don't have very much solid reasoning behind them. But the Russians and the Chinese don't care. They really just want the American people to get to a point where we don't know what to think, and where all we know is that the other side is evil and deserves to be slaughtered. That's their goal. And we've seen video footage this week of some of these troll farms. It's very sobering to see these trolls. Many of them are operating dozens or even hundreds of phones at the same time, just posting nonstop, filling YouTube and Twitter and Facebook and other platforms with all of their vitriol. So to anyone listening right now who's frustrated with the online discourse, of course, there are plenty of actual American radicals and plenty of real extremists out there, but it's very likely that many of the accounts that you're seeing that seems so hateful and so unhinged, it's very likely that many of those are not your fellow Americans. And they're not even real. many of these are just trying to discourage you and sort of fill you with despair. And I think that one good way that we can fight back against this insidious attack is just to refuse to play our role in the charade. You know, we can disengage, we can unplug the computer, we can put the phone down, we can go for a walk, spend time with loved ones, you know, read a good book. All of that is better for us, and it's worse for these nations that are actively working toward our destruction.
That's a really fascinating story. I mean, I'd seen some people, it explains a lot. I'd seen some people saying, well, Israel assassinated Charlie Kirk because he was questioning the Gaza invasion. And I was like, nobody could be dumb enough to believe that. Like, if Israel went around assassinating members of the MAGA movement who had bad things to say about Israel, like half of them would be dead by now. The idea that they'd be like, all right, Tucker Carlson or whatever, that's fine. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But Charlie Kirk asked a question. All right. Like, it's just bizarre. There's zero logic to it. But the idea that actually no one does actually believe that, and it's just the Chinese shedding trouble is an interesting one. And then also that last story that you mentioned reminded me of a new story that we wrote up briefly for our morning brief this week, where British young people aren't going outside. They're not taking your advice. And that's part of the reason why the world is going crazy. A study of 2,000 British adults found that 2/3 of Gen Z and 57% of millennials said they sometimes stay indoors for days at a time, with screens being the biggest reason cited. So, well, and you know, we end this show pointing out, you know, go on our website, order these books. You know, we're very happy to send you these books. Study the books. Yes. I would encourage you to get a print copy so that you don't have a screen in front of you and you can close the distractions and just focus on the book and the Bible. But you know, reading it online is fine as well. But in addition to that, go outside this weekend as well. You know, spend some time in nature. That's good for our health. That points back to God created nature and the outdoors, and there's a lot of positives that come from doing that. I'm planning on wrapping the show up, heading home, having a Sabbath evening walk with my family. So and we have a show as well about the Sabbath. We talked about that on Wednesday's show. Charlie Kirk kept the Sabbath. Should you? That was in the second half of the show. I think we'll publish that as a standalone as well. So thank you very much, Jeremiah, and all of our panelists. Thanks to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production. We will be back on our Wednesday show. Please do like, subscribe, leave us a comment. We'd be very happy to hear from you. You can shoot us an email, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'll be back on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.